This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Ever drive down the road and pass one of those historical markers a lot of places erect and wonder what it's all about? You can do that a lot, and if you stopped at all of them, you'd never really get anywhere. Well, not to worry, and please excuse me for using this way overused line, but there's an app for that.
Rather than just looking at fast food restaurants and gas stations, what about other things? What about the little town that's right there off the road?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the people behind Next Exit History and learn how a stop for coffee on a road trip turned into a nationwide historical database. Then we'll stay with history and hear a former East German reminisce about the fall of the Berlin Wall. Try to find out why charter school students in Ohio are doing much worse than public school kids, and spend an academic minute only joking. Really, I was only joking. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There's an app available now for your smartphone that will lead you to some of the country's most and least known historical landmarks. The app is called Next Exit History, and it was developed in a partnership between the University of West Florida in Pensacola and the Historical Research Associates of Portland, Oregon, a company specializing in historical and archaeological research and litigation support. I talked about the app and the partnership between HRA and the university with Dr. Patrick Moore, the director of the Public History Program at the University of West Florida, and Brad Bowen, the president, CEO, and senior archaeologist for Historical Research Associates. I started by asking Dr. Moore about the idea behind the app.
It actually didn't start as an app. It actually started as a concept that we figured we would create for Garmin GPS units, the kind that sat on your dashboard. About 8 years ago, Dr. Jay Clune, who's over in the history department, and I were traveling over to Tallahassee to a meeting early in the morning. Jay needed a cup of coffee, and so I said, oh, I got a GPS unit. So I pulled out my computer, my laptop, plugged it in, and after, 8 minutes of getting it up and running, figured out there was a gas station coming, certainly probably more than we needed to do to find a gas station. But the conversation started, what other kinds of things could you do with it? And rather than just looking at fast food restaurants and gas stations, what about other things? What about the little town that's right there off the road? And out of this came the concept of Next Exit History. It was developed entirely here. Dr. Dave Dawson, also here at UWF, and then Tim Roberts. The four of us developed this program. And moved it forward, assistance from the Florida Humanities Council. Then we got some grant money to look at the entire state, the little cities that were popping up around the state if you were driving down the road. And then we got attention of the Secretary of State's office. We became the official app of the Viva 500 program through the Secretary of State's office. And the Department of Transportation, our logo and app information was up in every rest area in the state of Florida, usually outside, not in the restrooms.
There's something that didn't exist 5 years ago, the official app.
The official app, exactly. So, and in time, when we first came up with it, this idea of information objects, the structure behind it that Dave Dawson was involved with, we always thought that someday your computer will be hooked up. Little we know that smartphones would come onto the horizon and then it would become ubiquitous. So we created this app. We moved it forward and started partnering with a lot of different groups and organizations around the state. And it got to the point where for just the four of us trying to run this, we all have full-time jobs in addition to this little project we were working on. It became suddenly necessary that we try and look to either, cut bait or figure out how we were going to expand it. And that's when the opportunity came up to partner with Historical Research Associates. And that's been a whole new opportunity, which has evolved over the last few years.
Let's just talk about first the content that's actually on the app. Who decides what merits being, a hit on your app?
And actually, that's a great question. We're not a wiki-based app, so it's not that anybody who has anything interesting to put in there, it's there. But rather, this is all reviewed content. It's created by historians. We look at how we can do quality storytelling, tell things that are exciting and interesting. These aren't really long, drawn-out, pedantic pieces that will put you to sleep, but rather what we like to call historical haiku. They run down to about 250 to 300 words, so just enough to get you excited and interested and say, I want to go and check this out. So it's created by professional historians here at UWF. Our graduate students worked on a lot of the early pieces. Now everything is vetted and structured through historical research associates. And we also work with a lot of state organizations. All of the historic markers, or many, almost all of the historic markers throughout the country are in the database. So if you drive by something that's been put up by a state highway department or other state historical organization, I wonder what that said. I don't have time for it. Those are in there as well. So you're able to have a broad spectrum of information that's all content that has value. And some of it may be out of date, but there's always opportunities for reinterpreting it, looking at it in new ways.
Tell us about the partnership then. When did HRA come in?
Just within the last couple of years. HRA is an organization that's been around since 1974, doing history, historical research, litigation support, archaeology, historic preservation, a variety of things. But over the years, we have the same issues that academics do. How do we make what we're doing relevant and interesting in the modern world, so to speak? So we got interested in trying to find some vehicle to do historical content through an app 4 or 5 years ago, but struggled with, we don't do this. We're historians, we're archaeologists, we're not app developers. How are we going to do this on our own? And through our connections with the National Council of Public History that Patrick's very involved with, we met him, and some of the folks in the company already knew him previously. We approached him actually about joining our board of directors with the idea of him helping us link with some of the same people we were looking for. Little did we know that they were already well on their way to developing the type of app that we were looking for. And so that's how the partnership started. So Patrick serves on our board as well as in the past year, or have hired him for about a part-time or a half-time position with us and half-time with the university to help us get this off the ground. So our vision is, how do we take what they've done, the structure that they've created, and really go national with it, really get a lot of organizations to participate in it across the country, if not globally.
So you've gone from historians and archaeologists to content providers.
Yeah, that's right.
And app developers.
Yes, and app developers. But I really think of it as just a different medium. I think I recognized that the world was changing the first time I picked up an academic textbook from a high school textbook that 10 years after I went to high school. They looked very different. All of a sudden, they had these little windows and these little bubbles and these, they were multimedia, which is not the way most of us learned. And it really dawned on me, I think, back then, that the world is moving into a different arena of how they want to receive and interpret information of any kind. And historical content is just one format that we have to keep up with, the demands of the digital generation.
Well, I'll ask you the same question I asked Patrick. What makes historical content? What makes you say, okay, this is something that people driving by will want to know about?
Well, for us as a private organization, it could be a variety of things. It could just be our existing clients and what they want to do. So that might drive a great deal of what we focus on. Right now, we're doing a project with one of the public utility districts, which out on the west, there's a lot of utilities that are very locally owned by the county. And they had the need and desire to do some public interpretation, public education around all of the work that they've done for years and years with the relicensing of their hydroelectric projects. Well, typically we would write something. We would write a history about that, and we would do a very good job of it, and we would print it, and someone would put it on their shelf, and that is the last time anyone would look at it for many, many years. So that's a lot of what drives what we are interested in. But also, we're interested in creating partnerships with organizations who already have content. There are many, many museums and historical societies and points of interest, places, Colonial Williamsburg, places downtown Pensacola, places that already receive a certain number of visitors each year because of their historical sites, and they're always interested in how they expand that. It's, at a certain point, it becomes an industry, and you try to figure out how to make it bigger and better, how to make it richer, how to keep people here longer, how to bring more people in. And so that is a lot of what's driving our interest, too, is looking for organizations and locations out there that fit that bill and are looking for a way to deliver more content out there to the world without having to develop an app on their own. And even if they have their own app, to be able to partner with a national and international app that might have users from all points, you know, across the globe.
And just about every small town in America has got that historical marker or that little museum that nobody really ever visits that
exactly.
probably want to get that word out.
And really, that's one of the great things about this, that so many communities, if you look at Next Exit History as an economic development engine, that every community has a rich, exciting history, something that's really compelling, but often is lost, that people don't have an opportunity to grab onto and understand it. And Next Exit History enables those communities to actually get on the map, if you will. We know that Next Exit History is something that people will download. Currently, we've had over 30,000 downloads between our different platforms. We're actually the largest, the most downloaded heritage tourism app on the market right now. Other things like Google Field Trip, they show points of interest, but we actually do interpretation. And we know that we're going to find those people. But one of the exciting things coming out within the next several weeks, the programming is finished and we're just converting it to make sure that it's compatible with the current operating systems, is a new gaming feature where people go and they don't just visit a site, but they can check in and they earn points for it and they can earn badges for it and they can share it on social networking. And then they can answer trivia questions about it and earn more points. And there's a scavenger hunt item. So even without necessarily knowing that you're participating in the history learning process, that it's a game. But it's a game where they're engaging with the community in different and exciting ways and earning points by it and telling other people. And it's kind of cool. I set up a little example of this with a Boy Scout troop that I'm the scoutmaster for. And I had put it on an iPad and I showed my scouts on it. And they were, you know, history, ugh. Then I said, well, give this a try. Next thing you know, they're running around this little downtown area on the Alabama-Georgia border looking at everything. And I thought, if you can get a bunch of boys on their way to Boy Scout camp to get excited about history like this, you're onto something. And so we're trying to provide that same experience for people as they travel around the country and allow them to discover history that they never would have discovered otherwise.
Dr. Patrick Moore is the director of the Public History Program at the University of West Florida. And Brad Bowen is the president, CEO, and senior archaeologist for Historical Research Associates of Portland, Oregon. Again, the app is called Next Exit History, and it's available now at the App Store for iPhones or Android devices. You can also use the interactive database at HRA's website. That's HRASSOC.com. As long as we're talking about history, this month marks 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. The city of Berlin is commemorating the German reunification with its largest anniversary celebration yet. Kristen Schultz grew up in East Berlin. She was 12 when the wall fell. She shared her memories of life before and after the reunification with reporter Jess Clark in Berlin.
Christine Schultz and her family lived in East Berlin in a towering apartment building made of unpainted concrete. Today, it's hard for most Berliners to imagine calling one of these austere towers home, but Schultz says her building was luxurious by East German standards for that time.
For us and for my family, it was just the state of the art because you had heating, you had toilet in your apartment, which never happened before, really.
Schultz's family always had enough to eat and clothes to wear, but luxury items like fancy toys, good chocolate, oranges, or melons were rare. Schultz said university was very unlikely for a girl from a non-party family like Schultz's, and travel to the West was out of the question.
As a kid, I would have never been able to go to America, for example. I would never been able to go to Spain or to France, to all these places you read in your books about.
On November 9th, 1989, peaceful demonstrations throughout Germany led to the opening of the Berlin Wall and eventually an end to the division between East and West Germany. Schultz and her family went to join the demonstrators who were physically tearing down the concrete barrier that divided their city.
on that day on the wall, the people were just so friendly to each other because they were always saying, hey, let the kid go in front, let the kid see something. So they just pushed me to the wall saying, hey, you need to look at this, you need to look at this because something really huge is happening right now. And then they were handing me over all these pieces of wall, and I had like a whole handful, and I just gave it to my dad, said, hey, you need to keep that.
German reunification brought new possibilities for Schultz and her family, but it also brought uncertainty. Food suddenly became more expensive, and Schultz's parents, like many East Germans, didn't know if they would be able to keep their jobs.
I remember there was one thing when when we were making dinner, and I had to peel potatoes as a kid, right? And so my mom said, maybe you should try to peel the potatoes not as thick as you did. And for me, there was a horrible moment because now I thought, now we don't have enough to eat anymore when she says that.
In the end, Schultz's parents got to keep their jobs. In fact, they eventually made enough to build their own house. But even though Schultz says life is better in a reunified Germany, many East Germans experience nostalgia for the Soviet era, a feeling they call ostalgie.
I think a lot of people, what they miss is that closely knit community feeling. Because in a community where everybody has very little, the community feeling is stronger than in a community where everybody has everything.
Schultz says she personally doesn't get nostalgic, but she still identifies as an East Berliner.
I will always be someone from the East. Not because I, you know, like that nostalgia feeling, but because we just grew up differently. It's just a different way of dealing with certain situations, I guess. But yeah, I would always define myself as coming from the East.
In Berlin, I'm Jess Clark.
Still to come, there's a big difference in performance between public and charter school students in Ohio. We'll check it out next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1261. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The largest teachers union in Ohio and a progressive think tank have released data they say shows mixed grades last year for students in the state who need to pass a key elementary school test. But State House correspondent Karen Kassler reports officials in Ohio say that data may not tell the whole story.
Last year, students in charter schools failed the state's third grade reading guarantee test at twice the rate of kids in traditional public schools. That's according to KnowYourCharter.com, a site set up by Innovation Ohio and the Ohio Education Association using data from the Ohio Department of Education's website. Dale Butland with Innovation Ohio says the worst performing traditional public school had a 61% reading passage rate. The worst performing charter school in this set of data had a passage rate of a little over 18%. Butland says passage rates in the worst 10 traditional public schools were around the mid-60% range. But in the charter schools, passage rates were in the low 20% to upper 30% range.
Clearly, these results show what largely these results on all the performance measurements show, and that is that while a few charter schools do very well, the vast majority underperform the traditional public schools.
But this data may be misleading, says John Charlton with the State Department of Education. He says final figures from last year's third grade reading guarantee tests are not ready yet.
The results for the number of students that passed the third grade reading guarantee standard from last year of 392 have not been released yet. We're still waiting to get that data and take a look at that.
Charlton says that data should be available in December. Butland says he thinks the data that's already been posted is an indicator of what's to come, and waiting for more data may not yield much change.
they don't like the scores that these charter schools are showing in terms of their performance. I think that's largely the problem. Facts are facts. It's not some liberal plot or some teachers union plot. The facts are what they are.
But regardless of what these numbers or the final numbers show, Charlton says one thing is not in dispute. Third graders have to pass the third grade reading guarantee test, or they will not be fully promoted to fourth grade.
It's the law. These are public schools. The charter schools or community schools here in Ohio are public schools, and they have to follow, for the most part, the same requirements that the traditional public schools have to follow.
Butland says the Know Your Charter website was set up to give parents data and information about charter schools in a much easier way than what's available on the ODE's website. But Charlton says the Know Your Charter website only picks certain data from the state's website, which he says stores far more information about charter and traditional public schools. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Have you ever been offended by a joke? Have you ever had to assure someone that you were just only joking? Apparently, that's not a bad thing. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Jokes can be offensive depending on the content, context, and who delivers them. Steve Gimbel, professor of philosophy at Gettysburg College, examines the ethics of joking.
We'll often try to excuse ourselves from the implications of things we've said by protesting, "I was only joking." When we make a joke, we're being playful with words. Jokes are meant to display our cleverness or our appreciation for some joke writer's cleverness. Most of all, they're meant to amuse our audience. But we also take jokes seriously. Gilbert Gottfried lost his job as a voiceover actor because of jokes he made. Politicians are regularly apologizing for jokes they sent by email. Jokes can hurt, demean, or silence others. Clearly, there's an ethics of joking. But joking is a complicated matter. There are different kinds of jokes, different audiences, and different situations. A joke that's fine for one person to tell can be morally problematic for another. The difficult project is to enunciate clearly the conditions that make a joke acceptable or problematic to tell in a given context. Since the political correctness movement of the 1980s, we've used the notion of offensiveness to do this work, but it's a deeply problematic notion. Different personalities are offended by different things. Sometimes the offense is unwarranted, and other times it's good for people to be offended, as it's only when we shake people up that we're able to realize our presuppositions that themselves could be harmful. Comedians, from time to time, have made the world a better place. And it was often by making jokes that offended those who were defending an unjust way of being. But if not offensiveness, then what? The answer is to look at what a joke does. Is it a mere display of cleverness, or a way of saying something we otherwise would have been reluctant to say publicly? Does it silence a voice, or does it force us to look at something in a different light? Sticks and stones can break our bones, but the question is if the joke can help or hurt us.
That was Steve Gimbel of Gettysburg College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.